I'd like to try to give you a little bit more of a sense of where I think our culture is going, because I believe that that is very important. As a matter of fact, I might add at least a disclaimer tonight, and that is, you probably noticed this morning and probably will notice tonight, that I spend a long time in analysis and not a lot of time in solution. And the reason for that is at least twofold. One is an emphasis of priority. Anybody that listens to my radio show from time to time hears one of what we call Anderson's axioms. I have a whole collection of little sayings, and one of which is, beware of the person who gives answers before he or she understands the question. And I think there have been far too many people who haven't really understood in any great depth what is happening in our culture and are all too quick to sell you a solution. But second reason for that as well is that I do believe that the answers are ones that you will have to work out. Individually, for example, there are just so many diverse elements, even in this congregation, that it would be difficult to come up with a one-size-fits-all kind of answer. The solution or the way in which you deal with some of the crises that I suggest are coming would be different if you're 55 years old and an empty nester. That would differ very dramatically, say, and then if you were 30 years old and single. So I think you have to recognize that there is a diversity in terms of the individuals, but also a diversity in the church. A church that is an urban church and has a certain kind of outreach to a different kind of demographic group would be different from, say, a church that is in a suburban network or area. Churches in Oklahoma are going to differ in terms of their outreach compared to churches in New York. So I think a lot of this will come as you think through these issues and try to apply them to your lives. And I hope that I can stimulate that. I will intentionally end early. Let me see if I'll end maybe about 10 before 7. That'll give us about 10 minutes for questions and just see how far we can get in that amount of time. Lastly, I know that some of you that are not baby boomers or baby busters feel kind of left out. So I wanted to kind of open with something that is dedicated to you. You may have seen this a while back. It is dedicated to those who were born before 1945. And it's entitled, We Are Survivors. Consider the changes we have witnessed. We were born before television, before penicillin, before polio shots, before frozen foods, Xerox, plastic, contact lenses, Frisbees, and the pill. We were before radar, credit cards, split atoms, laser beams, and ballpoint pens. Before pantyhose, dishwashers, clothes dryers, electric blankets, air conditioners, drip-dry clothes, and before anyone walked on the moon. We got married first and then lived together. How quaint can you be? In our time, closets were for clothes, not for coming out of. Bunnies were just small rabbits, and rabbits were not Volkswagens. Designer jeans were scheming girls called Jean or Jeannie, and having a meaningful relationship meant getting along well with our cousins. We thought fast food was what you ate during Lent, and outer space was the back of the Riviera Theater. We were before house husbands, gay rights, computer dating, dual careers, and computer marriages. We were before daycare centers, group therapy, nursing homes. We had never heard of FM radio, tape decks, electric typewriters, artificial hearts, wood processors, word processors, yogurt, and guys wearing earrings. For us, time sharing meant togetherness, not computers or condominiums. A chip meant a piece of wood. Hardware meant hardware. And software wasn't even a word. In 1940, made in Japan meant junk. Think about that one. And the term making out referred to how you did on an exam. Pizzas, McDonald's, and instant coffee were unheard of. We hit the scene when there were 5 and 10 cent stores where you bought things for 5 and 10 cents. Sanders and Wilson sold ice cream cones for a nickel or a dime. For one nickel, you could ride a streetcar and make a phone call, buy a Pepsi or enough stamps to mail one letter and two postcards. You could buy a new Chevy coupe for $600, but who could afford one? A pity, though, for gas was only 11 cents a gallon. In our day, cigarette smoking was fashionable, grass was mowed, Coke was a cold drink, and pot was something you cooked. Rock music was grandma's lullaby, and aides were helpers in the principal's office. We were certainly not before the difference between the sexes was discovered, but we were certainly before the sex change. We made do with what we had, and we were the last generation that was so dumb as to think you needed a husband to have a baby. No wonder we were so confused, and there is such a generation gap today. But we survived. What better reason to celebrate? So we dedicate that to some of you that maybe can't relate quite as well to the baby boom, baby bust generation. And I think it underscores some remarkable changes that have taken place in a short period of time. If you think of the changes that have taken place just in the last 3 or 4 decades, you've got to, I think, understand almost immediately that we are in the midst of major change. But yet, one of the flaws that I see church after church making is that they assume that the future is merely going to be an extension of the present. I am well aware of churches that have built Christian education centers in communities where there are very few children in the community. They have built large sanctuaries to reach out and to develop ministries when the function of the sanctuary is entirely different from the demographics in that community. We, I think, have to recognize that we have gone through a remarkable number of changes, but some of those changes will continue on into the 21st century. And as we track what these changes are going to be, we need to not be reacting to what has been happening in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. We need to be anticipating and reacting to the changes that are going to be taking place in the 1990s and the year 2000 and beyond. And if the Lord tarries, He is going to ask us in leadership to be responsible for those changes and to minister to those needs. And oftentimes we're ill-equipped to begin to minister to those needs because we're still living off of the past capital, living off the past experiences that we've had. So what I'm trying to do tonight is kind of stretch us a little bit and give us a little bit better perspective. Let's turn the slide projector on, and I'll kind of pick up where we left off this morning. If you weren't here this morning, I'll try to give you enough background so it won't be too difficult for you to follow. But we did end at about 11 o'clock today talking about the changes in the family. Remember I said that I thought that the families of the 1950s and the families of the 1990s are going to be very different? We've already seen some of the differences taking place. And I think some of the reasons why families in the 1990s are very different are due to these 3 points. First, husband and wife employed. Second, smaller families. And the third, the growth of the non-family or non-traditional family households in our country. Let me go back and kind of take each one of those sequentially to try to give you a little bit of a handle on what we're talking about. Dual-income households. Remarkable statistics. Very significant changes that have never happened before in Western culture. Just to give you a handle, women 16 to 68 in the workforce, 56% now, the best estimates we can come up with, 65% by the year 2000. But that next statistic, I think, is even more intriguing, because as you look at women with preschool children, you can see immediately that a higher percentage of women with preschool children are in the workforce than women in general. Women with children under the age of 6, 68% now, 90% by the year 2000. Now, the standard response that has come from people like Jim Dobson and Gary Bauer has been yes, but that 68% includes both full-time and part-time women. There's a lot of part-time women in there, and that's being used by advocates of daycare to get an Act for Better Child Care bill through Congress. I agree. But the issue is that a very small percentage, interestingly enough, of those women are part-time workers. And as I pointed out before, what I think is germane is the fact that during the 1950s, yes, you had lots and lots of women in the workforce. During the 1940s, you did. During the 1960s, you did. But the pattern up until recently has been that the woman would work, leave the workforce to raise children for a period of time, and re-enter the workforce. One of the slides I did not put in here, but I've created, is a slide that shows the number of women who are in the workforce who had a child within the last 12 months, and that number continues to increase. So the long-term implications of that are many-fold. One that we talked about as I answered a question, the implication of daycare. One has to wonder about the long-term implications of daycare on the next generation. Your children are in daycare. I'm not trying to put you down, but it is, I think, something to consider about the effect that daycare might have. For a number of women, daycare is the only option that they have if they're a single parent. It is either go on the welfare rolls or go to work and to try to provide a better standard of living for the children that she has. But I think for a lot of women, there are choices that they might be able to make as to whether or not they want to be back in the workforce, whether or not they should be in the workforce. And if any of you want to pursue some of that, I wrote an article a number of years ago for Moody Monthly about daycare and about the issue. And there's some calculations that have been done, and have found that a lot of women that go into the workforce actually lose ground economically. Because the time you add in the increase in their income, you have to also add into the number of meals out, the clothing, the house, the extra needs for taking care of the housing, the gas, and all the rest. And a lot of women are really asking the question, is it worth it? And more are beginning to say, maybe we need to come back to a simple lifestyle. But the reality is also that a lot more families are busier than they've ever been before. And I suggest to you that a big issue for the church in the 1990s is going to be the issue of discretionary time. What I say in my book is simply this. What was the big issue in the 1980s, income, discretionary income, now has changed in the 1990s to be discretionary time. More and more baby boomers, more and more families are facing a time crunch like they have never faced before. Now, candidly, that was somewhat unexpected. People did not expect that we were going to be dealing with a crisis of time or a time famine in the 1990s. In my book, I document some research that was done by a Senate subcommittee back in 1968, and they were plotting out a number of curves. First of all, they were seeing that with the advent of computers and satellites and all sorts of technology, people were able to get more and more done. And at the same time, the work week was beginning to drop significantly over the last couple of decades. And so the prediction was made that by 1985, they believed the biggest problem we would have is what to do with all this free time we'd have. They were predicting that there would be people that would be working 26 weeks a year, be working 20 hours a week. Some people would be retiring at the age of 38. Well, now, I don't know about you, but my wife, Suzanne, and I haven't spent a whole lot of time trying to figure out what we're going to do with all this extra time we've got. What happened? Well, since 1973, Lou Harris poll estimates that time available for families, leisure time, has shrunk a full 37%. Now, what happened to all this technology? Because the computers are whirring away and satellites are beaming signals and all sorts of high-tech stuff have been invented. But what's happened? Well, first of all, as wages stagnated, more and more demands were placed upon individual workers. The technology increased our expectations about what we might be able to get done. And so with all of those demands and with a competition for higher job skills and with the crunch of middle management and upper management, because there were too many boomers and too few upper management jobs, competition increased dramatically, and all of a sudden, we came to an issue of the time crunch. And one of the things the church is going to have to deal with in the 1990s is the fact that if you don't think that couples have time now, you haven't seen anything as we play this out into the 1990s. A time crunch is going to be more and more significant, and we're going to have to think through some of the demands that are placed upon families, and think through creatively how to reach out to people who, especially if they're not Christians, feel like they just simply don't have time for church. They don't have time for their spiritual life. They don't even have time for their families. And in many cases, we're going to have to challenge them to reorder their priorities. A second thing I want to talk about is smaller families. As I pointed out before, at current rates, women will average 1.8 children. To put this in perspective, let's look at just a couple of statistics from the Census Bureau. Married with children, 40% of households in 1970, now 28%. The category of married with children has been declining for the last two decades. And that again says that when you think about families, most of the time we think of families with kids. More and more of those families are married couples without children, adults living alone, or adults in a relationship, but they are not tied together by blood or marriage. So very different kinds of family structures. But one of the implications I talked about this morning, which I'd like to come back to, is it used to be in the 1950s, the center were on the kids. Remember my stories about Davy Crockett, coonskin caps, Whammo, hula hoops? the market was the 50s. In the 90s, the market is not the kids. The kids are not the market anymore. The adults are the market. The baby boomers are the market in the 50s. The baby boomers are still the market in the 90s. They're just older kids. See the point? And what has happened is we have turned this culture into an adult-oriented culture. Think of television. What kind of shows did we see in the 1950s? Well, this morning we talked about a few. Ozzie and Harriet. You know, Leave It to Beaver. Those kinds of programs. Ponderosa. Sid Caesar's Show of Shows. Ed Sullivan. Which one? Batman. That was sort of a 60s show, but close enough. You know, it's still in that. The emphasis on those programs was what? What was the target audience? Wonderful World of Disney, okay? What could you assume about those programs? Good, wholesome family entertainment. You could put your child down in front of any of those shows and know, basically, that there may be an exception here and there, but basically the programs would reinforce the core values of the American experience, right? Turn on television today. Matter of fact, don't turn on television today. What are the kind of shows we have in the 1990s? They're adult-oriented programs, aren't they? They are programs with adult themes. Now, my oldest loves the Wonder Years. And I might say, well, that's aimed at kids. Not really. The demographics are such where they have won with the fact that it is an interesting show to kids. And she thinks Fred Savage is such a cute fella. But the show works not because it attracts kids, because there aren't enough kids turning on television sets at that hour. But it also attracts baby boomers who look at the show, and it reminds them of their rite of passage when they went through junior high school. I think the 1950s music, has it ever seemed strange to you? You can walk into a restaurant and hear music that was recorded 30 years ago, sometimes 40 years ago. Our kids are living through the 1950s that we lived through. And the reason for it is that those programs attract the baby boom generation. And so we live in an adult-oriented culture. The media illustrates that. The reason we have X-rated films, NC-17 films, the reason we have cable television that's always moving the envelope, the reason you have so many adult themes is in part because programmers trying to attract the big audience, that pig in the python we were talking about, it's an older group. And so they go to older themes. But also, young people are not growing up in a youth-oriented culture. They are forced, in many cases, to grow up in an adult-oriented culture. Hence the notion of the hurried child. David Erskine wrote the book, The Hurried Child, or Doug Field's new book, which I think is even a better book, Too Old, Too Soon. The emphasis is, you need to grow up. The emphasis on the adult. And a lot of parents today are parenting through themselves. In other words, when kids grew up in the 1950s, the parents were saying, we want to meet your needs as best as we can. Today, the baby boomers are saying, I want to meet my needs, so grow up quickly. Now, in reaction to that, there have been some interesting things, because some have gone to one extreme of you've got the latchkey kid, the kid who takes care of himself or herself. Swinging to the other side of the pendulum are two different movements which seem similar but are very different. One is the hurried child syndrome, where the children are given the best opportunities. I mean, we're talking French lessons at 4, gymnastics at 5, world travel at 6, and Encyclopedia Britannica at 7. You know, and the child is given the best of everything one can imagine. Suzuki violin lessons at 5. All sorts of opportunities which sometimes at first blush seem like they're an emphasis on the child. And sometimes they may be. But oftentimes, if you peel back the veneer, it's a desire for the parents to have the child perform well so that we reflect positively back on the parent. Now, another swing from that pendulum is a positive one, and that's what we've talked about also this morning. The homeschool movement, the Christian school movement, the rise of various Christian ministries to reach out to families, I think are in large part due to the fact that Christians especially have looked out in our society and have said, it is really sad what our society is doing to young people. And we believe that children are arrows in the quiver. They're a gift of God, and we are going to set them in our midst, and we are going to give them the best education we can possibly give them. But a lot of those trends go back to this basic phenomenon of living in an adult-oriented society. The last part of this three-point message, this section here, is the growth of non-traditional families, or what the Census Bureau calls non-household households. It is for the government to come up with that kind of oxymoron. Non-household households. Now, the category of adults living alone has always been in the Census Bureau, one of the categories. Back in the 1950s, about 6% fit in that category of adults living alone. That was primarily due to death, widows and widowers. But since that time, due to some of the other D's of the 1990s, divorce, deferred marriage, personal choice, and the rest, we now have about 24% of the American population fit into the category of adults living alone. And some people predict, and this one I'm not so sure about, this one's, you know, a little more tenuous, but some are predicting, given the current trends that we have, of one of the highest divorce rates in Western culture, and lifestyle choices, not only of baby boomers, but now of the baby bust generation, the 20-something generation following it, that we could, by the year 2000, have 33% of the American population in that category of adults living alone. Again, let me reemphasize what I said this morning, and that is, when you are thinking of ministering to families within the church, if you are thinking families like Ward and June Cleaver or Jim and Margaret Anderson, guess again. The changes within families are dramatic, but the growth of non-families is even more dramatic. Lots of implications here, but certainly one is an emphasis upon singles ministry, but also a concern of continuity. One of the difficulties that a lot of churches have in terms of trying to develop any kind of singles ministry is just the state of flux of a singles ministry, less influenced by social norms. A family comes in, buys a house, and especially in some markets, kind of owns that house for life. Can't sell it again or doesn't leave, gets involved in the school system, develops a lot of social ties. Single people oftentimes move around a great deal more. They're less influenced by social norms. They're not necessarily tied to schools or to jobs or things of that nature. And so a much more difficult kind of ministry, but a very fruitful kind of ministry in terms of developing a ministry to those adults living alone. Look around your community and you can find whole pockets, whole segments of individuals who are living by themselves and are dealing with issues of priorities and loneliness, some of the things I've talked about just this morning. With that, let me go on and try to give you at least a little bit of a sense of where some of these trends are moving. Again, these are just basic statistics. Don't write down the numbers unless you're obsessive compulsive like I am, but, you know, this is all in the book if you want to get it, or even free radio pamphlets from various programs I've done on this are quite available, so you don't need to write them all down. But look at the trend. Family households, 81% in 1970, down to 72% in 1988. Married couples, 71%, down to 57%. And the statistic we looked at just a minute ago, married with children, from 40% down to 27%. You see the general direction in our society? The church is going to have to be much more astute in trying to minister to and to meet these kinds of needs. Now, up to now, really, I've talked about what you might call demographics, the social numbers of where our society is going. Let me switch just for a second and talk about what marketers call psychographics. That is, what's inside the psychology of individuals and the baby boom generation. Remember how I did this a couple of times this morning? Oh, I can do it a lot of times. I took out some slides just to make it simple. Moving from traditional families to non-traditional families, to non-traditional families, traditional, non-traditional families, we just kind of see these float, you know, we have a high number of traditional families, but very few, low number of non-traditional families, they increase. But we see that same kind of trend taking place in terms of the psychology of the baby boom generation. And I think the best way to illustrate this is to come back to a study that was done back in 1924. If you ever took a, actually it was done even before that, but that's the one that was made it famous. And it was a study known as the Middletown Study. If you ever took a sociology class, you probably studied this. Back before they had the Gallup polls, people tried to get a handle on American attitudes. And most of the surveys, not having the millions of dollars necessary to conduct good polling, not having telephone polls and all the rest, most of these surveys weren't worth anything. They were just terrible. So somebody came up with a bright idea. Let's not try to survey all of Americans. Let's just go to one town that's kind of representative of America, kind of Middletown, USA. And we'll survey these people in depth, and that will give us a kind of a snapshot of the United States. Well, it turned out later that many people found out that Middletown, USA was Muncie, Indiana. But it was a good place to kind of get a feel for American attitudes. And in Muncie, Indiana, the Lynns did some surveys, and one of the questions they asked parents were, what traits do you value in raising your child? What traits do you, as a parent, and then mostly you're talking to mothers here, what traits do you value in raising your child? In 1924, the highest values were loyalty to the church, strict obedience, good manners, and patriotism. There were a lot of flag burners back in 1924. The highest values were, again, loyalty to the church, strict obedience, good manners, and patriotism. The lowest values were independence, tolerance, and social-mindedness. Well, in the 1970s, somebody said, hey, you know, it's been about 50 years. We got to go back and ask that same question now of the granddaughters, or in some cases daughters, mostly granddaughters, of the people we asked that question of in 1924. So it's kind of like instant PhD dissertation. I mean, what a great idea. So they went back to Muncie, Indiana, and they asked the same questions. And one of them was, what traits do you value in raising your children? The highest values at that time were independence, tolerance, and social-mindedness. And the lowest values, you guessed it, were loyalty to the church, strict obedience, good manners, and patriotism. You see the change? Same kind of change. We've heard a lot about return to traditional values, and I wish it were so. I wish it were so. And if you can find me some evidence, I'd love to say so, because I'd love to be optimistic, but I don't see that. Not only in the structure of families, but in the attitudes communicated in the families, we're moving away from some of the bedrock assumptions of previous generations. In 1924, look at those values. Highest value, loyalty to the church. Strict obedience, good manners, patriotism. This is Norman Rockwell's America, the core values of the American experience. But in 1978, some things had changed. Mommy was going off to work, and so there was a need for independence. You could grow up. We are going to have you do some things that we've maybe not asked other kids, but we've got to ask you to do them because we've got busy schedules. Tolerance. You know, Aunt Sally's involved in the New Age movement. She thinks she's kind of flaky, but we need to tolerate her. And social-mindedness. The world had changed, and so as a result, the family had changed as well. What I think we have going on are some remarkable changes taking place in our society. Changes in the structure of the baby boom generation, and changes in the structure of the family. Let's turn it off there. I don't really have time for any more slides, and I want to give some time for some questions. But what I think we need to understand is that with those changes, there are some tremendous opportunities. Think through just what you've heard so far, and that is, I mean, I imagine that some of this you've kind of heard and said, well, some opportunities that's a little bit discouraging, too. I mean, how did we get here? And these sort of create a whole set of new problems or crises or issues to deal with. And in my book, I talk about seven coming crises that will affect your life. The first is a crisis of purpose. As I pointed out this morning, baby boomers are turning 4-0 in record numbers. Isn't that a scary thought? Every single year, 3 million baby boomers turn 40. My wife turns 40 tomorrow, by the way. Which is, and I will follow shortly, but I still have a few months of the 30-something years. But that, I think, illustrates a point, because in that time, there is a whole-scale reevaluation of what an individual does. Daniel Levinson, in his pivotal study at Yale University, figured that at least 80% of the men in the study that he dealt with went through some kind of major midlife reevaluation, which best would have been identified as a midlife crisis. And a lot of baby boomers are going to be asking the question, who am I? What am I doing? Where am I going? Is there anything else in life? Because some baby boomers, about 5% of the baby boom generation qualify as yuppies. Only about 5%. But that 5%, you know, they were the first to the jobs, and they were the first to the high incomes, and they've done pretty well. But the problem is, it hasn't been very fulfilling. I saw a cartoon in New Yorker the other day, and it is this guy turning to his wife, and he says, "Sally, you know, the egg timer is pinging and the coffee pot is perking, but is this it? Is this the American dream?" And a lot of baby boomers are going to be facing a crisis of purpose. Second crisis is a crisis of disillusionment, because most baby boomers have not done very well financially. Most of them say, "Hey, you know, my dad went off to work and my mom stayed home and I came home from school and there were cookies and we had cars and vacations and a house, and we're not making it. And I'm doing poorly, and I don't know that I'm going to get out of this dead-end job, and I can't make ends meet right now." A crisis of broken promises, and most baby boomers fit into that category. They're yuppies, not yuppies. Yuppies are young urban professionals. Somebody coined the term yuppies. They're young urban failures. Or they're dinks, you know, double income, no kids. Or for those in ministry, double kids, no income. But whatever, maybe some of you, right? They feel some days. Got lots of kids, but no assets. Isn't ministry fun? But a crisis of disillusionment. Others are facing a crisis of priorities. Too many choices, too little time. Just unbelievable choices. A pluralization of worldviews, of options, of experiences, of restaurants, of cars, of whatever. And also, at the time, we have more choices, and we're just sort of almost incapacitated by those choices, kind of the cafeteria syndrome. You ever had a Yankee come down to a cafeteria down here in Oklahoma City, and they go through the line, they're going to, never seen so many choices they had to make. But then, added to too many choices, too little time. Too little leisure time, choices, but not enough hours in the day to make the choices, if I wanted to make the choices in the first place. And a whole question of crisis of priorities. Some are facing a crisis of relationship. That is, they're facing the fact that they grew up in a dysfunctional family and they're trying to keep it from happening again, but it's starting to. Highest divorce rate in history amongst the baby boom generation. One out of every two baby boom marriages will end in divorce, most likely, according to Cheryl Russell of American Demographics. And one out of five will divorce twice. And all sorts of problems with addiction to various kinds of substances and other kinds of problems that just seem to almost be proliferating in our society in untold ways. For many, a crisis of loneliness I talked about this morning. A question of, who will take care of me? This baby boom followed by a baby bust creates a problem when that baby boom wants to retire. And it needs the people following them to support them in Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, pension funds, insurance. And baby boomers are saying, you know, who will take care of me? And especially if I've never been in a relationship with anybody, who really will take care of me? Some are facing, because of that, a crisis of security, financial security at least, a sense of, how am I going to plan for my retirement? Most baby boomers do not have money set aside for their retirement. They are up to their eyebrows in debt and don't see any way out of it soon. But even if they do, they say, well, that's okay. I've got some money squirreled away in a savings alone that doesn't exist anymore. Or in Social Security, which is kind of the government oxymoron. Social Security isn't secure. I mean, social insecurity, you know, it's like jumbo shrimp or gourmet pizza or postal service or military intelligence or whatever, you know. I mean, social insecurity doesn't look well at all. And finally, a crisis of spirituality. A lot of baby boomers are saying, hey, there's got to be more to life than life. But where do I find that spirituality? Baby boomers are coming back to the church in record numbers, but that's only because they're sort of a boomerang, you know, the Capistrano effect. You know, they went out and they floated back. But a lot of baby boomers were never in church in the first place, and they're looking for spirituality, but they aren't going to the church. They figure that's the last place they're going to go. Guess where they're going? The New Age meeting. Wrote a column a while back here. Welcome to get a free copy of it. Why is the New Age movement growing? And the answer is just as simple as it can be. It's growing because baby boomers looking for spirituality but denying the power of Jesus Christ are looking for some kind of spiritual experience, and they are coming to the New Age movement. And we really stand at another one of those crossroads, don't we? Because if the Church of Jesus Christ is willing to reach out, those people can be brought into the church through an outreach of small groups, through various evangelistic outreaches. We can reach this generation. But if we don't, they are going to make the New Age movement grow in unprecedented ways. A lot of them did drugs in the 1960s, followed and read Carlos Castaneda. So it's not a big jump from the 1960s experience into the New Age of the 1990s. And that's what may be taking place. But even though I have shared with you, I think, some very dismal statistics, I am very excited about the potential for the church in the 1990s. For this reason. These negative statistics are going to have a significant impact on the baby boom generation and on the baby bust generation. The baby boomers have up until now been almost inoculated against the gospel. They've had no interest in spiritual things. Why? Because they've done pretty well, thank you. But the wheels are starting to come off. Problems are starting to develop. And during the 1980s, they say, well, maybe it's going to get better. I mean, it got better for my parents, but now they're starting to see it's getting worse, not better. And a lot of them are starting to feel like failures. A lot of them are starting to say, what is life all about anyway? And as I said this morning, those are good questions. Evangelistically, I can work with those questions. Just think of how you felt just as I was going through some of this. You know, I talk about Social Security, pensions, and debts, you know, loneliness, whatever. Just think of the emotions you had, just as we talked about those very briefly. And I got a whole set of slides that could put you into a deep purple funk if you want when you start looking at the numbers. But just think of how you felt about that. Think how you'd feel if you did not trust in the sovereignty of Jesus Christ. You did not trust in the sovereignty of our Lord. You did not have Jesus Christ as your Savior. And that kind of feeling is going to start having a ripple effect in our society, and I believe that we as the church may be at the very edge of a window of opportunity that we have never had with this generation. And if we use this opportunity for God's glory, then I believe that you better start knocking out some walls here at Metropolitan, because you're going to have a lot of people here. Because if people believe that you want to help meet their needs, they're going to come in droves, because no other institution in society is dedicated to meeting their needs and can meet their needs other than the Church of Jesus Christ. You know, some churches, when I say that, I almost get an amen. But anyway, let me stop here and see if I can try to answer a couple questions. We'll take questions for a couple of minutes, and then we'll stop. Excellent question, and I'll apologize in the front end for giving a shorter answer, because that's almost a message in itself. The question was, given the issue of lack of commitment and pulling that together with the issue of priorities and a lack of discretionary time, will we have to go to a position where we may have to have, say, more vocational staff? I disagree with that, but let me just say that there are really two issues that you have to walk. It's almost like a knife edge we have to walk here. On one hand, we have to reach out to this generation, but on the other hand, we don't have to buy their lifestyle. You know, whether it's an outreach function or whatever, I think there's a legitimate place for saying you need time and to reach out and to say we want to help you with your time, but in that also really challenging them with their priorities. The crisis of priorities results because their priorities are out of whack in many cases. Interestingly enough, there was an article recently in Newsweek magazine called Return to the Simple Lifestyle. Even non-Christians are starting to say, wait a minute, this lifestyle, this, you know, this this fast-paced, frenetic lifestyle a lot of us seem to be caught up in, this is for the birds. And even though they're not Christians, they're going back to a simpler lifestyle and really saying, these are the important issues, my family and my time in my community. And I think we need to be challenging Christians to do the same. The biggest concern I have, and I'll be hard on Christian radio for a minute, but since I'm kind of in Christian radio, I guess I can say this, is that as I have analyzed Christian radio programs after the last couple of years, I am convinced that a lot of what we are doing is trying, especially in some of these psychology programs, to help people adapt to an insane system. In other words, we're saying, you know, I know they're asking you to work 80 hours a week, so let me just try to support you so you can work 80 hours a week. And, you know, I'm ready to say the system is insane. Why don't we just, like the emperor's new clothes, say it is insane, and let's start changing the system instead of trying to help Christians cope with this stupid system, which is at its very core rooted in secular humanistic values, which aren't right in the first place. Now, once I say that, I know that we're calling for a cost of discipleship that might mean some of you lose your job. So I'm not saying this lightly. I've got friends who did take some of these principles seriously, and they lost their jobs as bank presidents, treasurers of major corporations. And that was not an interesting phenomenon for a bank president, a good friend of mine, for example, who went then for the next 5 years without a job. Because there aren't just a whole lot of jobs for banks. There aren't many jobs in banking, period, but bank presidents especially. And so there is a real cost, a price to pay for that. So I'm not saying that with any kind of cavalier attitude, but I am saying that we may just need to kind of restructure the way we go about our ministry. What I do believe, and I think you've probably heard me say this before, is I strongly believe in lay-led ministry. There have been two reformations. One was the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, that put the Bible in the hands of the laity. And we're in the midst of a major reformation taking place right now, which is putting the ministry in the hands of the laity. I don't think anybody on staff here would say, hey, you know, we're doing the ministry, you just stay back and watch. I think the emphasis all the way through this church, and should be through every church, is let's get more people involved. But as they get involved, let's help them reassess their priorities. And sometimes our priorities are caught up in a materialistic lifestyle. They're caught up in a fast-paced, frenetic lifestyle. They're caught up in trying to maybe even indulge our children too much. I mean, I love my kids, but, you know, after a while you have to say, okay, one activity, two activities, no more. I mean, lots of wonderful opportunities, but you have to be a student of your children to say, no, we're not going to run from every t-ball game to every soccer game to every basketball game to every gymnastics lesson to every ballet lesson, piano lessons, and all. I mean, somewhere along the line, even those very good activities need to be limited so that we can do what the calling is. So I don't believe that we necessarily have to move in that direction. If anything, I think the great expansion of the church will have to and should come from the involvement of people in the ministry doing more of the ministry. The outreach to baby boomers is not going to come by bringing them to the church, although you could have a 50s party and things like that, but that's not the point. Very few baby boomers are going to walk the aisle here and become Christians in this church, this building. But a lot of people are going to become Christians if you have evangelistic small groups, evangelistic outreaches in the community and reach them and bring them here. But they're not going to just walk in someday, although some will because of the needs that they have. So it seems to me that as we energize all of you to be ministers, believer priests, as the scriptures teach, then I think we will have that outreach. And I think the churches that keep their budgets lean and are able to shift resources well are going to be able to be more adaptable in the society. I'm fearful, candidly, of churches that have big overheads, big staff, and big budgets. They may not be as effective as we move into the 1990s. And I gave you a real short answer to something really I could give point after point. But thank you for asking that question. Let me see if I can answer maybe two more. In the there was no baby boom in Europe. It was kind of a post-war phenomenon like the U.S. Census Bureau had predicted. But in four countries, the United States, Canada,
Australia and New Zealand, a baby boom did take place. And the most profound one was in the United States, because this one lasted 19 full years. But also, because of the baby boom, it has affected other cultures. So some of these attitudes now have surfaced in other countries. So this was one export that came from the United States that went across the ocean. Rock music, for example, came from the ocean back, and Eastern philosophy came from India, and humanistic and liberal religious philosophy came from Germany. But so there's been some shifting back and forth. But where we are today, at least demographically, is due in large part to the baby boom, which was pretty much almost a uniquely American phenomenon. But the sociological and philosophical issues we talked about this morning, some of those are universal. And one of the most striking things that has happened in our society today is you no longer have really regional pockets. There has been a globalism in both the good sense and the bad sense of that word, a uniformitarianism, if you want to use a geological term to try to explain it, of making the whole world one big globe, one big global village, one uniform mall, I guess, you know. Every mall looks like every other mall. Well, what has been happening in the commercial area has also been happening in the philosophical area, which, for our young people, is interesting. It used to be, as I said, trends came from older to younger, and they went from white to black, usually, not always, or white to ethnic. They went from suburban to urban, affluent to, less affluent. Those have almost all reversed themselves, and now a trend which would take 5 years sometimes to make it around the society comes and goes almost with blinding speed due to the fickleness that was sort of built into the system of the baby boom generation and due to mass communication. Madonna can do an MTV video, and within 2 days everybody knows what it's about. Somebody can coin a new phrase and use it on some talk show, and within days everybody's using it. A new style can come and go.